Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and it's me and Simon Lambert today. And coming up, a new mortgage deal from Yorkshire Building Society means first-time buyers could get on the property ladder with as little as 1% deposit. Genius or a potential trap? Watch out, shoppers are being warned of a new gift card draining scam. How much is enough to retire on? Simon answers a reader question. And finally, it's that time of the year, so where are the experts investing their ISAs? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, aspiring homeowners can now get a savings account designed to help them save for a deposit from Yorkshire Building Society. The new regular saver deal comes alongside its 99% mortgage, which was launched this week and allows first-time buyers with a £5,000 deposit to buy a property for up to £500,000. It means they'll potentially be able to get on the ladder with as little as 1% deposit. Simon, welcome. How does it all work? I presume you don't need the savings account to get the 99% mortgage. It's just a way to help you get there. But just explain how it all fits together, what Yorkshire's doing.
Okay, so what Yorkshire Building Society has done has released what has been described as a 99% mortgage or a 1% mortgage. Depends which side of the coin you want to look at it from, but it's the same thing. And that's quite controversial because people buying with very small deposits leaves them exposed to the potential of negative equity, which is sure something that we'll get onto in a minute and talk about. But the logistics of this is that it's not a 99% mortgage as we would know a 99% mortgage. It's actually a mortgage where you need to save a £5,000 deposit. And with that £5,000 deposit, you can buy a property up to a maximum value of £500,000, which would be 1%. But you have to bear in mind that that is very much an edge case scenario. Most people taking advantage of this mortgage, which actually is probably going to be a relatively small number anyway, won't be buying £500,000 properties. But, for example, if they bought a £200,000 property, then the deposit would represent only 2.5%. So we're not talking about big deposits that people are putting down here. And usually people are advised to put down around about 10%. So you get your £5,000 deposit, you go to the Yorkshire evaluate you on their various criteria. And this is where anybody trying to buy a £500,000 property is going to face a stumbling block because they're going to need to have salaries. And I say salaries because it's highly unlikely one person is going to be doing this alone, but salaries that are big enough that enable them to borrow £495,000. So they're going to have to be pretty high earners because they're going to have to pass the affordability checks. But if they did, they could buy that £500,000 property. Obviously, you can buy properties that cost less. The logistics are buyers will need to fix for 5 years at a rate of 5.99%. That is higher than most rates on the market, but it doesn't have a product fee. On a typical £200,000 first-time buyer mortgage, that would equate to paying £1,170 a month if you were paying over a 25-year term. And also, crucially, the mortgage will not be available to those purchasing flats or new build properties. And this is something that YBS is building into this product to try to protect people from that threat of either negative equity or the property that they buy going nowhere over the next 5 years, whilst other properties go up in value.
If it's a sort of niche, listening to you, it might be suggested, what is the point of this?
What's the point of this? Well, I think the point of this, and it was quite interesting actually listening to Yorkshire Building Society's representatives who were out discussing this earlier in the week and very much having to defend it in a sense, because it's quite controversial. What they're saying is that people face a major barrier to getting onto the property ladder from having to save a deposit. house prices have gone up substantially. As house prices go up substantially, percentage-based deposits go up substantially in monetary terms. And because it's a percentage of a big number, whereas your earnings tend to be a smaller number, it becomes harder and harder to save that large amount. So, you know, if you look at the average house price of £290,000, someone saving 10% for that's going to need £29,000. That's a tall order, saving £29,000. Mm. It's hard enough to save £5,000 once you've paid all your bills, your rent, you know, your taxes, all that kind of stuff. And Yorkshire's saying, we think £5,000 is an attainable target for people to try and save, which is why it's also brought out a savings account to try and help people at the same time. And if they could do that, we think that in that case, you know, we will lend them this money and do that. And what they also said is that what this is trying to do is help those people who don't have access to the bank of mum and dad. And one of the key things about this, I guess, is that there are many scenarios where people, even buying with a really small deposit, could end up paying less on their mortgage than they do on their rent.
Is this just building societies doing what building societies do for the good of their members? Or is this something that says more about the time that we're in, finding new avenues, being more creative?
I guess it's both, really, if we're going to be honest, isn't it? Building societies, you have to remember, the clue is in the name. They're there, you know, to help people buy homes, to help people own property. It's built around that kind of principle. And they're also there for savers as well. And they're owned by their members, they're mutuals. We talked about this the other week with the discussion about Nationwide taking over Virgin Money. And by being mutuals, they are meant to put their profits back into the business in order to help their customers, their customer members. And that is, in a sense, what they're doing here. They're saying, okay, we're going to come up with something that helps people buy a property, and then we're going to come up with something that helps them save. We're going to be a bit innovative. We're going to be pretty tight on scoring people on affordability and credit checks and everything like that. We're not going, hey, knock yourselves out, but we're saying we're going to offer you this. Now, on the flip side, obviously, there is this concern about negative equity, and the suggestion from some quarters and critics of this scheme that Yorkshire Building Society, as one of the country's biggest building societies, shouldn't be encouraging people into a situation where they are at high risk of negative equity. But, you know, to go back to that point I made about the rents, if you were buying a £200,000 property and you put £5,000 down, and bear in mind, in lots of parts of the country, a £200,000 property is probably about a kind of first-time buyer property, right? It's not going to get you much in London and the Southeast, but £200,000 is a pretty decent amount for first-time buyers across most of the UK. You'll be have a total monthly payment of £1,678, right? And a lot of people are going to be £1,168. I think I said, which is the correct figure. Sorry. And a lot of people are going to be paying potentially that or close to that in rent. Again, you go outside of London, that's going to decrease the chance that they are. But what people need to remember, of course, is that it's not just a straightforward comparison between your rental costs and your mortgage. The cost of owning a home is substantially higher than the cost of just renting one. Because when you're renting one, your landlord is picking up the tab for lots of things that you don't pick up as a tenant, but that you will pick up as an owner. If something goes wrong as an owner, you have to pay for it. If you need a new boiler, or you need a new washing machine, or you need a new dishwasher, or the place needs a paint. Now, there's going to be lots of people sitting here thinking, well, I'm a tenant, my landlord never does any of those. It took him about 3 weeks to get me a new boiler. But the landlord is responsible for that. You can hold them to account, and you can move, you know. And actually, one of the great complaints of tenants is they keep getting moved too often, and every time they move, the rent goes up. But there is also an advantage to being able to move. Whereas you take out this deal, you're going to be in that property for the next 5 years, and you are buying with a deposit that's so small that when it comes time for you to move, if things go against you, it's going to be harder for you to move than it would if you managed to get a bigger deposit. And so you need to make sure that you're going to be happy with that property for the next 5 years. if you're going to outgrow that property in 2 years' time, or you're thinking about having a child and it's a one bedroom place, and you're going to do that in the next 5 years, or, you know, or you're going to need to move for work or many other things, then don't take a mortgage like this. You know, you need to make sure that, in fact, buying any property, I would say to most people, you need to make sure that you're happy to live there for the next 5 years. And if you're not, then wait until you can find a property that you are happy to live in for the next 5 years. But to Yorkshire's credit, the fact that you can only do this over 5 years does mean that people will be paying down that mortgage over those 5 years. So although they're starting with a 1% deposit, potentially, most of them will be starting with a bit more than that, they will end up, hopefully, with more equity in their property. They just won't be in as good a position as the person who started with a 10% deposit.
What are the alternatives, Simon?
Well, there's a number of schemes to try and help people do things like this, around and about. So, and Barclays has its springboard mortgage, for example, which requires family and friends to help with the deposit. In this case, the helper provides a 10% deposit as security for 5 years, and it's placed into something called a helpful start account, which earns interest and then is then returned to them after 5 years. Skipton has a track record mortgage, which is designed to help renters get onto the property ladder. You know, by the renters have proved they've got a track record by paying rent. So there are a few of these things. And then there's the old fashioned guarantor mortgage, where you've got family or friends to basically guarantee the mortgage for you. Broadly speaking, it would be family. It was a way of tapping into the bank of mum and dad without actually making them give you a load of money. And then you've got the, you know, I was going to say the traditional bank of mum and dad route. I love the fact we've now got a traditional bank of mum and dad route, which is basically trying to convince, stroke, coerce your parents into giving you some money so that you can buy a property, which is what is happening in many cases for first time buyers and home movers nowadays, because we have a generation or two generations at the top who have built up substantial amounts of property wealth over the years due to rising house prices. And then we have the generations at the bottom who are trying to buy said properties and discovering that it is very, very difficult indeed. Now, the economic criticism of something like this is that if you just keep lending people more money in order to be able to buy the expensive thing, the price of the expensive thing will not come down. The only way the price of the expensive thing will come down is when people run out of the ability to pay for the expensive thing and the market has to readjust.
Quite, Simon. So with all of these sort of schemes, it's a bit of buyers beware, I think. Just really know what you're getting into.
I guess so. I mean, like, I mean, what do you think about it? Because I mean, I'm in a very fortunate position. I've been a homeowner for, I don't know, like 15, 17 years, something like that. It's a long time, right? Whereas you've been renting much more recently. And so, and the difference between somebody who managed to get on the housing ladder 15 or 17 years ago and someone trying to get on it now is colossal. And it felt bad enough when I did it, you know, back then. So, you know, what do you think in terms of the fact that this would potentially have enabled you to buy a place for less than you were paying in rent?
I'm going to, for not wanting to sound like a bit of an old fart here, the reason that I didn't buy is because I didn't know where to buy. And I travelled around, I'm a journalist, I move around, and I like renting. It allows me to live in places better than I could have probably afforded at the time. So over the sort of 10 years, or however long I've been saving, I've saved a fairly hefty deposit. So now I've taken the decision, I know where I want to buy. I have a very good deposit to put down on a property. I'm in no rush. This idea of people wanting to move in really quickly when they're young and saying that they're forced to move in there with their partners so they can afford a deposit. My God, if you are being forced to move in with a partner in your 20s to buy a property, just don't. I think it's sort of a mindset change. You know, I worked pretty hard for a hefty deposit and I rented all that time. Do I sound like an old fart, Simon? You know,
I didn't
get any money from the bank of mum and dad. You know, I did it all myself and I enjoyed renting. I don't see it as wasted money.
I don't think so. I think that's a really good point, actually, saying that you don't see it as rented money. Sorry, that you don't see it as wasted money, because people do look at it like that. They go, oh, well, I'm just paying all of this to a landlord when I could be paying off my mortgage. And there is that. But then there's also the other things that you could be doing. And, you know, overall, potentially, you know, throughout long periods of time, renting is slightly cheaper than the cost of owning a home. Not slightly cheaper necessarily than the cost of a mortgage, but it's slightly cheaper than the actual cost of owning a home. And you have to tie up a lot of money in the house, don't you? That could be doing something else.
And you could live somewhere miles away. You know, the opportunities that I've been able to move quickly, move for different jobs. You know, potentially my earnings have been higher because I've been able to move around. So, you know, I think there's positives for everything, but that's just my view. Talking of buyers beware, though. Shoppers. Let's talk about scammers and shoppers. Shoppers being warned of a new gift card draining scam imported from the US. Now, it sees criminals siphon off money from vouchers before the recipient has had a chance to spend it. This is money was alerted to the scam's presence in the UK when reader Lorraine, not her real name, contacted us to say her family had become victims. Simon, take up Lorraine, not her real name, story. You can pick another name if you want. I mean, it's okay.
We'll go with
Sandra.
Lorraine. That's what
Yeah, okay.
Helen, Crane chose in this story
Okay.
as the pseudonym.
Okay.
Now this
Good
story
name.
is an interesting one, because if you go into the supermarket or the shop, in many places, there is just like stacks of gift cards just hanging up by the till, aren't there?
Yeah.
You know, they're not allowed to put the sweets by the till anymore, but they can sure
Gift
put the
cards.
gift cards there, or they've got them on those revolving racks. And it's like any company you could think of. Some of them, like where it's like a gift card for something really mundane and boring, and you're like, oh my God, if somebody got me a gift card for that, I wouldn't be very happy about that. You know,
Yeah,
oh,
I
gift
know.
card to pay some of my mobile bill. Thanks for thinking of
I know,
me.
yeah. Sainsbury's gift for card. Thank you.
Yeah, or you've got those like one for all or whatever they're called gift cards where you can buy it from like a gazillion different places. And there's you know, this is a massive cottage industry, this gift
They
card
have
thing.
Weatherspoons gift cards. That blew my mind. No
Do
one's yet
they?
to give me, yeah, honestly, no one's yet to gift me one of those for Christmas, but if you want to.
That's the modern day version of that classic, I can't think to buy a bloke what. I can't think what to buy a bloke present, so they get some beers and a beer mug. It's
Imagine going
like,
into Weatherspoons with your gift card going, yeah, I love it.
yeah.
Anyway, we digress. So what's this story, Simon?
Okay, so
Scammers?
scammers, yes. And we were talking about this. It did lead to some bemusement when we were having our meeting the other day when Helen was telling us about this story. And I was like, oh yeah, of course, like you'd have to. They load up the money when you buy it, don't they? They don't just have the money on cards. They don't just leave money hanging by the tills. Because we were like, how are they stealing them? You just take them, and that's money. I was like, that's stupid. That's a security risk. You shouldn't leave money hanging by the till. Boy, I realized I was an idiot. Anyway, these cunning scammers, what happened with Lorraine? She gave this card to her niece. She tried to spend the cash on the Amazon website in January, but the money had already gone from the card. So she was suspicious when she tried to remove the plastic card from its paper backing and found it had been glued on, obscuring the code needed to validate the voucher online. She called Amazon to ask if the money could be credited to their online account via the voucher's serial number, but Amazon said the money on the cards had already been spent in mid-December before Laura even received them. So
Wow.
thieves steal the cards, which are often left hanging on the ends of supermarket shelves. Sometimes they swipe hundreds at a time. They take them away, scratch off the silver foil, obscuring the validation code, and then they copy down the numbers. They glue the card back onto the paper packaging, or they purchase like little silver foil stickers online, which make the card appear unused, the sticker back over, sneak the cards back into the shop, and then hang them back on the shelves where they are worthless until they are topped up with cash when someone buys them and takes them to the till. Once they're loaded with cash, the criminals exploit the fact that there's usually a gap of days or weeks before the voucher will be spent. They sit there with the validation codes and they just aim to get there first onto the card, which led to the question of how do they know which card has been
Right.
used? Yeah, we were like, have they got someone sitting there watching?
Yeah.
But actually, what you need to remember is a lot of this organized fraud is it's grunt work, you know. And so you've got people just spending hours and hours and hours doing this stuff. And what I suspect they've got is they're paying people small amounts of money to just sit there with codes and just keep typing the codes in until they eventually hit jackpot and they discover that they've got a card that's got some money on it. And then the main fraudster, not the poor grunt who's sitting there typing in codes, in some form of potentially organized crime scenario where they're having a very unfortunate existence, the fraudster then goes off and spends the money. And that's where actually, you know, we kind of made slight light of this with the whole money hanging on the end of tills and this gift card phenomenon and everything like that. But it is actually, you know, probably the tip of something really quite dark and nasty that's going on. But if it happens to you, then obviously you're going to be completely bemused when you go and eventually try to spend your gift card, which people can leave lying around for months before they actually try to spend the money and discover that actually someone's already got there first.
I mean, I also joked about the Wetherspoons, but are they taking the money out of the account or are they spending it at Amazon? Because can't imagine the scammers would be wanting to go and get that pint of tribute and a $3.99 curry.
I find it unlikely that Wetherspoons gift cards are the main target here.
Yeah.
I suspect that it's mainly the ones where you can actually buy goods from the shops that can then either be returned and they somehow manage to get a cash refund or they fence basically and flog them on. Unless, of course, the Wetherspoons fraudsters are sitting there outside Wetherspoons and saying to someone, fancy saving even more money on your Wetherspoons? I'll pay for it for you with my gift card. You give me half the price. Enjoy your pint of tribute and your fish and chips.
See, I jest, though, but, you know, if you are coming to buy a gift card and you are a bit unsure as to which gift card to buy, that's something to consider. So how can you spot the signs? You know, if you see a gift card on the rack, what are you looking out for?
Well, check it out. Have a look if it looks like it's been tampered with in any way. That is the key thing. Inspect the packaging and the card. Look at whether anything's been scratched off, if there's any material covering the pin. Does it feel like it's been glued onto the card rather than it's on that funny little blob of sticky plastic that stuff gets attached to with things? Mm. And also be careful about any website that you get asked to use because, you know, you might get... There might be a way that they've somehow managed to send you off to a dodgy website as well. I mean, you saw this with the QR code scams that we talked about on the podcast a while back, people putting up fake QR codes that are sending people to scam websites. And I guess the scenario is that 99% of the time when somebody buys one of these gift cards, they pick them up, chuck them on the counter, they pay for them through the till, whether it's self-service or with the person on the till, and away they go. And they don't really ever look at it properly. Put it in an envelope, give it to the person who's getting it, you know.
But gift cards generally, though, Simon, just a brief, I mean, I'm surprised that, you know, you said that the gift cards are everywhere. I'm surprised people still use them because the amount sort of shops go under or the fact that we barely, I mean, honestly, there must be tons I've got, you know, hidden in drawers.
That is the thing. You've got to watch out for those dates on them. I mean, there, as I said, there is a whole sort of cottage industry amongst this, including some of the ones where you can spend them at lots of different places. The lifestyle gift card, the one for all gift card. I'm looking at a one for all gift card at the moment, and you could spend money at M&S, Superdry, Currys, ASOS, TK Maxx, B&Q, Shoe, Halfords, Waterstones, Primark, Nando's, Argos, IKEA, River Island, H&M, Pandora, WH Smith, Boots, I think that's Pizza Express, New Look, Boohoo, Clarks, John Lewis, Holland & Barrett, and many, many more. I mean, you could just give people some money.
Yeah. I'm happy with that. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Lisa, welcome to the podcast. We've got a question to do with the tax year end, which is approaching very fast. What are the last minute things people need to do before the tax year ends?
The tax year end allowances are sort of use it or lose it. So you've got an ISA allowance of up to £20,000 that you will not be able to carry over into next year. Pensions allowances are a bit more complicated, but essentially if you can still contribute into a pension, I strongly recommend people to do so, particularly if they're higher or additional rate taxpayers. The tax benefits are great.
Can people get started over the Easter weekend if they're worried about running out of time?
They are running out of time. There are some things which are not possible or risky. But if you have a pension open, you can contribute to it up to, well, in our case, up to midnight of the tax year end. Similarly for ISAs, if you're making electronic transfers, you've got time as well. You probably don't have time, you can give it a try, to sell assets to reinvest in your ISA or your pension.
Thank you, Lisa. And you can find out all the details of what you need to do with your pension, ISA and finances before the tax year end in our special bonus This Is Money podcast episode that I recorded with Charles Stanley Direct's Rob Morgan, and we published earlier this week. Find that on your favourite podcast platform.
Welcome back. Reader question time. Now, how much is enough to comfortably retire on? You have a reader question, so let me read it out. I'm married, mortgage-free, and have two adult children, and I'm nearing 60. I hope to retire at 65, as my job is quite high pressure. I currently have $235,000 in my pot, all parked in the default fund. I will have full state pension on top. My wife also will have full state pension, but doesn't have a huge pension pot or savings. I'm paying 4% of my $62,000 salary in, and my employer also puts in 4%. Can Simon... you reassure this reader, and should they be paying more in? You've asked the experts, what did they say?
Okay, so this is an interesting question, right? Because you're nearing 60. So let's say this person's 59, right? You're going to get a full state pension. Good news. Your partner's going to get a full state pension. Good news. You're mortgage free. Good news. You've got a good job. Pays you 62 grand a year. Good news. And you've got £235,000 in your pension pot. Good news. Are you going to be able to retire when you hope to at the age of 65? Now, this doesn't feel like a massively ambitious target, does it? In fact, it's what most people manage to get to do until very, very recently. And it's been in the news over the last couple of weeks due to the WASPI women, hasn't it? But it might not actually be within the realms of possibility, which is crazy when you think about all of those things that I stuck my thumb up and did good news to. I understand, listeners, you could not see me sticking my thumb up, but Georgie can. So there you go. So what you need to think about is, how much is your retirement going to cost you? And this is what our experts have talked us through. We've got Simon Stigall, a chartered financial planner at Flying Colours. And we have Shelley McCarthy, a chartered financial planner at Informed Choice. Now, Simon said, a typical trend for retirees is often slightly lower expenditure in the immediate months that follow as they adjust to retired life, which is interesting. People don't get demob happy and start splashing all their cash on Lamborghinis. But then this is followed by higher expenditure as they start to tick off the retirement goals. Travel, holidays, golf, enjoying themselves, Lamborghinis, that kind of stuff. Then it starts to edge down later in life, because say you take someone who retires at 65, they're probably going to maybe, they might, if they're lucky, they do 65 to 75 doing loads of really good stuff. And then at 75, you know, they might want to continue doing that good stuff. I mean, I'm referring to 75-year-olds. My mother is 75. She works, she runs her own business. She looks after some of her grandchildren 4 days a week. Various other things. So actually, she just shows no signs of slowing down, and she's definitely still got an appetite for holidays. But you might find 75 to 80, people start to slow down and they spend a bit less money, and then they continue into their 80s and it kind of floats down a bit. But they do start to worry about things like the cost of care and stuff like that. So that's the kind of general spending pattern that you see. The state pension age is currently 66. And it's going to be 67 for anyone who is born after the 5th of April, 1960. So if you're retiring at 65, you're going to need to cover a couple of years without a state pension. And those couple of years are going to drain your resources that bit more. So then you need to look at, as I said, what's this lifestyle going to cost you, which is something that Shelley then brings up. And she uses our old favourite friends, the PLSA figures, which is the Pension Lifetime Savings Association's figures for how much different lifestyles are likely to cost you in retirement. A basic retirement, £22,400 a year for a couple, I'm going to talk couples here because this person's in a couple. A moderate retirement, which is a pretty good standard of living for most people, £43,100 for a couple every year. And a comfortable retirement, which is, you know, you're living pretty high on the hog. You might have to not get the Lamborghini, but you're going to be pretty happy. £59,000 a year, right? And actually, that £59,000 a year is quite interesting, because if you've got someone who's on a £62,000 salary, it's quite similar to the kind of money that you're getting in now. But if you're mortgage free and your kids have left home, hopefully you should be able to shovel some more money into your pension, which could build up that £235,000 pot. So what's this couple's income going to be? Right, so they need to get to £43,000 a year. And it's also really important to remember this is a post-tax figure, okay? So this isn't directly comparable, apples with apples here, but it's near enough, okay? Full state pension times two equals £23,000 a year. So there's a £20,000 a year gap after they start getting their state pension. Bear in mind, they need to cover those couple of years before they don't. What's the income on a £235,000 pension pot? Well, generally speaking, people are told they can draw down about 4% a year from their pension pot. And that would be £9,400 a year. Or potentially they could buy an annuity. They could take 25% tax-free lump sum, £58,000. And then depending on what kind of annuity they get, you know, whether it's a good one that pays out inflation-linked benefits and money to a spouse when you die and things like that, or whether it's just a basic one that just pays out a flat rate and doesn't pay anything out to your spouse, you could get between £8,500 and £13,000 of income each year. So whichever way you look at this, this person is going to be short about £10,000, £11,000 a year versus the cost of a moderate retirement income. And they also need to factor in tax. So in theory, potentially, they might struggle. So they need to try to maybe get as much excess money into their pension pot as they can over the next 5-6 years until they're 65. And hopefully that's going to A, benefit from tax relief and higher rate tax relief. So it's very tax efficient, and also hopefully from investment growth. And so their pension pot hopefully will be that bit bigger, which will help them out. And then obviously there's the things that you can do, like you could spend a bit less. You could go for something between the basic and the moderate retirement. I mean, you know, the moderate retirement is based on a three-year-old car replaced every 7 years. Maybe you don't need a three-year-old car and to replace it every 7 years. £175 a week for food, including takeaways and eating out. Maybe you don't need to spend that much a week on food or have those takeaways and eating out. You know, spend a bit less on holidays and things like that. And then also potentially, and this is, bear in mind, my own thoughts. I'm not a financial advisor. The answer to this question isn't individual financial advice. But I always think with this 4% amount, that's generally based on the idea of you taking the money out and still ending up with the pot left at the end. But I think people can maybe take a bit more out than that. You know, you've got to be careful because you're eating more into your pot in the early days. But you can maybe think, well, I'm going to spend a bit less later in life. Or also, maybe I should just run my pot down because my pension pot was not designed to give my children an inheritance. My pension pot was designed to give me a comfortable retirement. And that's something I think is really important for retirees to think about nowadays in the scenario where many more of them do keep their pensions invested, is they try to protect the capital value of that pension when really they should be running that pot down and enjoying their retirement. And I think if you ask most people's kids, would you rather your parents enjoyed their retirement or had their pension pot intact to give to you in 20 years' time? They'd say, I'd rather they had their pension pot intact to give to me in 20 years' time. No, they wouldn't. They'd say, I'd rather they enjoyed their retirement.
Yes, exactly, Simon. We would want our parents to enjoy themselves. I suppose two things spring to mind there is one, the value of speaking to a professional a good few years before you're looking to retire. And also, considering just before 60, you know, while you're working, perhaps sort of being a bit more frugal in the run-up to your retirement, and then you've got a few extra pounds to spend in your retirement.
Yeah, think like a first-time buyer when they're having to save as hard as they possibly can. In fact, maybe turn the tables, move in with your kids for 3 years before you take your pension and only pay them a nominal amount of, like, rent every month, you know, just a couple of hundred pounds.
Fantastic suggestion,
and then
Simon.
You can save all of your money, so much more money, into your pension. And that's way more tax efficient than saving for your first home anyway. So maybe that's what we'll see. We will see a new boomerang generation who
in reverse.
Exact their revenge on their own boomerang generation kids.
Yes, maybe not. Finally, it's that time of year. So where are the experts investing their ISAs? And what are the most popular funds? This is Money Where to Find Out. Simon, what did you uncover?
Okay. The first thing I've uncovered is today is the 29th of March. The tax year ends in 1 week's time.
Mm-hmm.
It may
you
not
knew that this... already. You didn't discover that. You knew that.
I've learned it like a Sky News correspondent. I've learned that today is the 29th of March, and I've learned that tax year ends in 1 week's time. And I've also learned that it is Easter this weekend, which I've learned gives you less time to act and put money into your ISA. Although I have learned that most ISA platforms will actually allow you to pay money in over the weekend. So don't just think you can't do anything until Tuesday. My point is, if you need to do something about your ISA or your pension, start trying to do that now. Ideally, you started trying to do it a few weeks ago, but if not, start trying to do it now. Don't leave it until Friday. Otherwise, you are leaving absolutely no margin for error for things to go wrong. And it has never been more important to do this stuff, because the Chancellor, in his wisdom, is staging an all-out tax raid on small investors by slashing the capital gains tax allowance again. So it's going to go down from 6,000 to 3,000 this time. And bear in mind, a year ago, it's £12,300 before he started cutting it at 6th of April last year. And the dividend allowance is just going to be £500, whereas it was £2,000 until not so long ago. He hasn't moved the personal savings allowance. Rates have gone up. Inflation's gone up. All those other things. So more of people's savings are being pulled in. And if you're one of those poor people who falls into the tax traps of child benefit or 60% tax trap above £100,000, cheekily, those tax-free allowances get... You get them, but you have to add the money that you got in dividends or in savings interest onto your income. So you actually start to lose some of your personal allowance above £100,000 or some of your child benefit based on what is theoretically a tax-free allowance. So that's the roundabout way of saying get your ass in gear if you haven't done it yet. Don't leave it waiting. Now, you wanted to know about where people are investing their ISAs, didn't you?
I do, yeah.
Right.
Once we've had that piece of advice, come on, Simon, we're all geared up.
Yeah, so that's the pep talk. The pep talk is over. Myron Jobson of Interactive Investor, and formerly of This Is Money.
Yes, of course.
Says he's investing to fund his holidays, buy a home, and for his retirement. Myron's not retiring for years. he's probably planning an early retirement. Myron's a really smart guy. What I was saying is Myron's younger than me. He's not retiring for years. He is putting a large portion of cash over the coming year into the Vanguard Life Strategy 80% fund, which predominantly invests in global equities with 20% invested in bonds. He says it offers ample diversification with fingers dipped into many investment pies, offering different returns and reducing the risk of financial loss. This is a cheap, basic tracker fund and a very sensible move. He also plans to put some money into some riskier investments and says he likes Scottish Mortgage, which identifies global hypergrowth companies and holds them for a long period. Recent performance has been shaky, but the trust is designed to be held long term. Tom Stevenson, investment director at Fidelity International, again, a very smart man who knows investing inside out, says he has invested part of his portfolio in the M&G Global Macro Bond Fund. He says, while the best time to invest in bonds may have passed when the yield on 10-year treasuries briefly exceeded 5% in October, government bonds tend to perform well around the peak in the interest rate cycle. If interest rates fall as expected this year, then bonds could provide a good total return combining income and capital gains. His other pick is the LNG Global Equity Index Fund. That is basically, again, a low-cost global tracker fund. Listen to what they're saying here about these cheap, easy, low-cost global tracker funds. And Sarah Coles, again, another person who knows her personal finance inside out, is investing part of her portfolio in the Legal & General International Index Trust, cheap, broad, global equity exposure. And she's building on that with the Rathbone Global Opportunities Fund. That's something that's an actively managed fund that's going to go looking for those opportunities. And looking at the list of the most bought investments, fund-wise, We've got Fund Smith, Terry Smith, still top of the pile. His fund has fallen behind the market in recent years. It's a bit disingenuous, some of those comments, when you talk about people falling behind the market in recent years, because the market has been driven so much by the Magnificent Seven. And if you've got any sort of position that doesn't say, right, I'm buying into this freight train rolling down the tracks at a very high speed, and I think that there might potentially be a problem here, then you're going to have underperformed. Okay. But, you know, Terry has underperformed. But again, you know, this is a man who really does know his investing, has delivered great returns for investors. Followed by the Vanguard Life Strategy 90% Index, the LNG Global Technology Index Trust. That's people using a tracker fund to invest in technology. Royal London Short Term Money Market. This is people parking money in money market funds that basically deliver like an interest rate equivalent return. Jupiter India, which is quite interesting. India's stock market, been doing very well. India is seen as a real kind of growth country. Vanguard US Equity Index, no surprise. The US market makes up nearly 70% of the global index now, so it's no surprise people are buying US trackers. Vanguard Life Strategy, 100% equity. That's all invested in shares. Vanguard FTSE Global All Cap Index, Vanguard FTSE Developed World, excluding the UK, HSBC FTSE All World Index. These are figures from Interactive Investor. Obviously, they will differ between platforms. What's interesting there is that there's a lot of index funds and trackers in there. Then if we look at investment trusts, Scottish Mortgage, City of London, Greencoat UK Wind, interesting contrarian play there, because these renewable energy funds have seen a real bashing in the price. JP Morgan Growth and Income, Alliance Trust, BlackRock World Mining, spicy, F&C, Merchants Trust, Polar Capital Technology Trust, the renewables infrastructure, and single stocks, people are buying Legal & General, Lloyds Banking Group, Rolls-Royce, Vodafone, Glencore, Aviva, BP, Helium One Global, which is interesting, Tesla, and Phoenix Group Holdings. And Tesla actually highlights something which I think a lot of people don't realize, is that you can actually buy overseas stocks in your ISA. A lot of people think you can just buy British stocks, which of course you can't, because we're going to get a special British ISA potentially. But yeah, you can buy overseas stocks in your ISA.
You mentioned a lot in that, Simon. I just want to know, perhaps an existential question, but given investing is for the long term, there's sort of an indication of where people see where we're headed. Is there anything that surprises you? Is there any themes that you think stood out particularly?
Yes. And I know I mentioned a lot there, but don't worry, listeners, there isn't going to be a test at the end of this. I think what stood out for me, as I mentioned, as I was talking through the top funds, was how much passive index tracker funds there are now being invested in. There's a huge amount of money going into that. In some instances, people are trying to pick winners, just doing it with passive funds. So like they're buying the tech index, for example. But in many instances, people are just buying the whole market. And that's a good approach. It's obviously the best kind of pure passive approach. Approach is just to buy the whole market, but it's also a good approach to maybe do this as the core of your portfolio and then have some satellite investments around the sides. And then that's where you start looking at, you know, things like some of these single stocks and investment trusts. I think it's very interesting Scottish Mortgage is still the most bought investment trust, because Scottish Mortgage is still down substantially on its peak. However, it's actually, we were talking about this in the office the other day. It's 3, 5 year and 10 year figures look great, but it is substantially down on its peak. But it's considered to, you know, be the giant that fell off its perch, I guess. But there is now an activist investor, Elliot, involved, that's trying to shake things up. The discount from the NAV to the share price has narrowed substantially. The question is, will the underlying holdings, you know, start really picking up, especially the unlisted companies, and could Scottish Mortgage come raging back? Then I think what was interesting was that, as I said, the Greencoat UK Wind, the Renewables Infrastructure Trust, BlackRock World Mining, people trying to buy into this kind of future trends thing of mining, we're going to need all those metals that go into electric cars and all that kind of stuff. Renewable energy, prices have taken a real knock as interest rates have risen, because people compare, you know, these largely as a kind of like, what can I get as a yield? And if the yield doesn't look great compared to what I can just get on this cash savings account, I might as well just put my money in cash. And then there's, you know, a big name in there that's been doing really well over recent years, but before that was very much suffering and actually was a target. of the same activist investor that has now got involved with Scottish Mortgage, which is Alliance Trust.
Simon, thank you so much. Loads in that. Do read the article, but you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions of the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. And actually, on the note of that question we had about the pension, we are doing more financial planning questions at the moment. So if you have a question about financial planning, or anything like that about your finances, send it in to us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk and stick financial planning at the start of the subject line so we can easily find it.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.